You know, in a few short weeks, there's going to be a very important election. And tomorrow, early voting begins, and I trust that you'll take advantage of that. If not, certainly vote on Tuesday, November the 6th. But I want to just ask you, has it occurred to you that in this election, and in many of the races in this election, you and I will have an opportunity to affirm not just a candidate, not just a political issue. You and I will have the opportunity to affirm a worldview. In fact, really, it boils down to two competing worldviews that are always at work, always at play in any election. And you and I have the opportunity to affirm one of those worldviews. The first worldview is the view and the thought and the conviction that we live in a God-centered universe, that God has given certain truths, that He is the source of all truth, and that everything we do and everything we say and how we order our lives is to be consistent with the truth. That's one worldview that we have the opportunity to affirm. The other worldview that could be affirmed is the worldview that we live in a random universe, a man-centered universe, and so really man just gets to decide what is convenient or what is profitable for him, and you have the opportunity, and I have the opportunity in this election to affirm one or the other of those worldviews. And I trust that you have studied carefully and prayerfully the issues that are at stake, and that you will affirm with your vote biblical values based upon that first worldview that I talked about. Now let's open our Bibles this morning to Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19 and verse 3. And I'm in a series of messages entitled Hazmat. Hazmat. The most dangerous ideas in your culture today. And the fact is that there is so much hazardous material that is floating around out there in our culture today in the form of ideas and thoughts and philosophies and worldviews. And they're hazardous because they lead people astray. And they're hazardous because, you see, ideas have consequences. Ideas have consequences. And you see, if enough people in any given society embrace a particular idea, eventually it will shape their culture. It will shape their laws, it will shape their leaders, it will shape the way they educate their children and their young people. Now, last week I talked about the lethal idea, the hazardous material, that there is no such thing as absolute objective truth. All that there is just your truth and my truth. And who's to say that my truth isn't just as valid as your truth? And so that's very dangerous because that leads people to simply believe and to do what is right in their own eyes, which usually means what is profitable and what is convenient and comfortable for me, whether it's right or wrong. Now, last week we talked about this lethal idea, but we also talked about the antidote to that hazardous idea, that hazardous material, is another idea that I represented in the form of a chain, what we call the chain of truth. And let me just review this, because everything we're going to talk about in this series of messages, hazardous material, the most dangerous ideas, all of it is going to relate back to the chain of truth. Remember, the first link in the chain is the existence of the one true God. And the fact is that everything that God thinks, everything that God knows about any matter, and He knows everything about everything, He is true in that. He is the one true God. Now, the big question is, how do you and I know what God thinks about an issue like the one we're going to talk about this morning? How do we know what God thinks about an issue which is truth? Well, we know that because of the second link in the chain, and that is the written revelation of truth in Scripture. That God revealed Himself in a perfect Bible, and we consult the Bible, and we turn to the Bible for guidance as we seek to discern what is true. what is ultimately, objectively true. The third link in that chain is that God knew that the revelation of truth would not be complete, the revelation of himself would not be complete until he became a man. And that happened in the incarnation. And the third link in that chain is the personal revelation of truth in Jesus Christ. That God gave us his written word, but then he came in the form of Jesus, came in a human body, the complete God, complete man, and he lived among us. And Jesus said, I am the way and the what? Truth and the life. No man comes to the Father but through me. And so the third link in that chain is the personal revelation of truth in Jesus. And then the last link in that chain is a life of obedience to the truth. A life of obedience to the truth. Now, if you will hang your life on this chain of truth, you'll never go wrong. If you will, if this becomes the way that you order your life and make your decisions and make your determinations about what is right and what is wrong, then you will never go astray. And today I want to apply this chain of truth. I want to apply this principle to the issue of marriage. Now, we live in a day and time when many people ignore the truth of God, and in so doing, they embrace a number of what I want to call marriage options. Marriage options. And that's the dangerous idea. That's the lethal, toxic idea that is floating around out there in our culture today, that actually there's not just one true definition of marriage, but there are many marriage options out there. And one of these is the so-called issue of gay marriage. Now, I say so-called because really gay marriage, homosexual marriage, is an oxymoron. It's like saying cold heat or dark light. The two words do not belong together by their definition. And yet, I'm going to use that because it's the popular phrase that is used today. Now, we may think that questioning the nature of marriage is a recent thing and a contemporary thing, but it really isn't. Questioning the nature of marriage goes all the way back to the time of Jesus. And here in Matthew chapter 19, we have an occasion in which Jesus is challenged by some religious leaders on the issue of marriage. And so I want to read Matthew chapter 19, beginning in verse 3. Some Pharisees came to him to test him. They ask, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? Have you read, he replied, that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and his mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate. You see, the enduring definition of marriage was established by God at creation, and it was affirmed in the teachings of Jesus. And no human or society has the right to redefine marriage. And so this morning, I want you to notice, first of all, the provision of marriage, the provision of marriage. Notice that this all begins, Jesus' response or his reply begins with the words, haven't you read? And so that tells us that what Jesus is doing here is he's referring back to the written revelation of truth, in this case, in the Old Testament. And he's basing his answer upon God's written revelation of that truth that we find in Scripture. Now, granted, there will be those who say, well, you're just assuming that the Bible is true. But I don't happen to believe that the Bible is true, someone may argue. There may be some good things in the Bible, but I don't think it's the final word. And you know, societies change and human beings are getting smarter and smarter and smarter, so it stands to reason that we need to adapt things in our culture today, including marriage. And a person has a right to that opinion. But that's just what it is. An opinion. And a foolish one at that. They are telling you something about their worldview, that they believe in a universe that is random with no standards for what is right and wrong, or that and in such a setting where everyone can just sort of do what they think is the right thing to do. And so obviously that degrades to the point where you have your truth and I have my truth. Well, that's a foolish worldview. And as I said last week, the only worldview that makes sense of life, that gives any sense of order and meaning to life, is the viewpoint, is the worldview that we have a universe that is created by God, ordered by the truth of God, and a universe that is accountable to the moral and natural laws of God. That's the only worldview that makes sense. This is called truth. And it is to this truth that Jesus appeals as he gives an answer to those who were trying to test him on this matter. But notice also that he says, at the beginning, in verse 4, at the beginning, the Creator made them male and female. And so what this tells us is that marriage came into existence not by the will of man. Now, I say this just about every wedding that I perform. As I stand before the bride and the groom, oftentimes right here on this stage, I will say to them that what we're about today is not something that man dreamed up or that man invented. Marriage is something that was created by God. It's a part of God's creating the man and the woman. And it says very distinctly that God made them male and female. And so at creation, God was putting in place not just the one marriage between Adam and Eve. It's very clear as you read the text in Genesis 2 and here in Matthew 19 and in other places like Ephesians 5 that what God was doing here is not just creating one marriage, that he was putting in place the prototype of a relationship that would become the foundation of all societies. The marriage relationship. That's why in Genesis 2 and in here, Jesus quotes it in Matthew 19 and verse 5, he says, for this cause a man will leave his father and mother. And so he's speaking here not just to Adam and Eve, because Adam doesn't have a father or mother. He was the original, wasn't he? I mean, God created him, unique. And so it's clear that the Father was looking forward to, he envisions an institution that would spread throughout his creation. The relationship in marriage between a man and a woman. So God, not man, established marriage. And he alone determines the guidelines for marriage. That is that God uniquely and deliberately created a male and a female who would be joined together in the first marriage, not two men, not two women, a male and a female. Now, there are at least three purposes that God has for the marriage relationship, for this one flesh experience that God designed. The first one is for pleasure, for loving intimacy between a husband and wife. That's one reason God gave marriage. The second reason is for procreation, and that is for the perpetuation of the human race, and that's why Jesus told them to go forth and multiply. Procreation. And then the third purpose for marriage in God's design was prosperity, that he wanted this family unit to become then the order and the stabilizing factor in society. And all three of these purposes are important. You see, if you only think of marriage in terms of pleasure, of sexual intimacy between a husband and a wife, and you ignore the fact that God created marriage for the purpose of procreation, which is not possible in gay marriage, you can understand that this was a part of the unique and beautiful design of marriage by God. And the important thing to know is that God did all of this for Adam and Eve while they were still part of an innocent, pure, sinless creation. God was giving them this relationship before sin ever crept in. It was a sign of his loving, gracious provision for his creatures, Adam and Eve, and those who would follow. And so we see the provision of marriage. But the next thing I want you to notice is the perversion of marriage. And the question that is given by the religious leaders, by the Pharisees, and by the way, their motivation really was not to get into a discussion with Jesus really about the issue. They were not really concerned about marriage. Their main motivation was to test and to trip up Jesus. But they do raise a very important issue, and that is the perversion of marriage. In verse 6, so Jesus said, so they are no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate. You see, sinful human beings found ways to pervert the beautiful and pure gift that God gave to humanity in marriage. You see, in Old Testament times, you may read along in your Bible and find that there were some of the men of God who had multiple wives. And then a little bit later, you read how that divorce begins to creep in and how they were looking for ways to put their wives away, to send their wives away in divorce for any selfish reason that they may have. And then there were men like the ones that were found in Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis chapter 19 who engaged in homosexual immorality. And so sinful human beings quickly found ways to pervert God's pure, beautiful gift of marriage. And we see this in the question of the Pharisees who were trying to trick Jesus. And they ask about one of these perversions of marriage. When was it lawful for a man to divorce his wife? And after Jesus gave them his answer in verses 4 to 6, they come back with a rebuttal in verse 7. Notice what it says. Why then, they ask, did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away? And so they were saying, well, wait a minute, Jesus. Moses must have condoned divorce because, after all, he gave a way for the men to outline the grievances they had against their wives, and then they could send them away legally. Notice how Jesus answers that in verse 8. Jesus replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wife because your hearts were hard. But it was not this way from the beginning. Remember those words when you think about any of the perversions that have arisen through history and even up to this very day. It was not this way from the beginning. So essentially, down through the ages, the perfect plan of God in marriage has been perverted by sinful, selfish desires. And you know, as I think about the United States of America, and I think about our, even just our recent history, there have been at least three major assaults upon the institution of marriage as it was defined and as it was designed by God Himself. And the first assault, the first perversion, came in the 60s and 70s in what was called the sexual revolution. It was an age of free love. And Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young had a song called Love the One You're With. And the chorus of the song says, if you can't be with the one you love, then love the one you're with. And that was the attitude of free love that was so pervasive in the 60s and in the 70s. And it was a time of great moral decay. And then that gave way. The next major assault followed on the heels of that with a rise in something called no-fault divorce. No-fault divorce. You see, prior to the establishment of no-fault divorce, a divorce could only be attained if one spouse could show or prove that the other spouse had done something harmful to the marriage relationship. It wasn't just that they didn't love each other anymore. There had to be proof. In order for the divorce to be granted, there had to be proof that a spouse had committed adultery or abandonment or felony or some other harmful act against the marriage. But that has changed. And since 1985, no-fault divorce is legal in and available in all 50 states. And then the next major assault on the institution of marriage has to be the most hideous of all, because it strikes at the very core of the marriage relationship as God defined it and designed it. I'm talking about the initiative in the United States to legalize gay marriage. Of course, this has been preceded by an all-out push to legitimize all forms of homosexual activity and to make it simply a normal way for human beings to relate to one another. You know, one of the largest employers in Fort Worth has a campaign going on that involves the distribution and the display of something called a pride mug. And the company's website has this notice. What is this campaign? The Pride Mug campaign is one way that individual employees can reinforce an inclusive environment in their own workspace. Now listen carefully. By having and displaying a pride mug, you send the message that you are someone who values diversity. It's not just what is said, but also what is not said that is important, reminds the vice president of diversity, inclusion, and equal opportunity. They have a vice president of diversity, inclusion, and equal opportunity and programs in this company. We need to recognize the power of different perspectives. Leaders also need to feel comfortable providing support. Displaying a pride mug is one of the many inclusive behaviors that encourage members of our workplace to bring their whole selves to work, to share their innovative ideas, and to exemplify teamwork. A sustained commitment to inclusion will continue to maintain and grow our business. What should you do with your pride mug? Display it at work. Use it as a pencil holder, as a paperweight, or drink from it. Any way you use it, you will be influencing the degree to which coworkers feel included, respected, and valued. In doing so, you are setting the standard without saying a word. Now, at the bottom of this announcement, there is a little footnote that says, Pride, P-R-I-D-E in all caps, is an employee resource group serving the company's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender LGBT employees, employee families, and friends of LGBT people. A whole division of one of the largest employers in Fort Worth is heavily involved. And that's the kind of pressure that's going to be increasingly felt in the marketplace to accept not just homosexuality, but homosexual marriage. You see, a moral wrong has become a civil right. Now, you will hear people say, well, and even some Christians say, well, wait a minute, those prohibitions against homosexuality in the Bible really don't apply to us today. After all, you just look at science, and you look at the way people are, and it's just that it just is what it is, and we should just accept all people and just let everybody do their own thing. And they will argue that those prohibitions in the New Testament about homosexuality are really just the ranting of a homophobic Jew named Paul 2,000 years ago. And I've even heard people say that Jesus never addressed the issue of homosexuality or gay marriage, so let's just leave it alone. Well, I'm going to just say today that you cannot explain away homosexual immorality any more than you can explain away heterosexual immorality. They are both immorality, and you cannot explain them away or neutralize them. And actually, Jesus did speak to the issue of gay marriage, when in places like Matthew chapter 19, he defines what marriage is: a union created by God involving a male and a female. And so in defining marriage in that way, by saying what marriage is, he was also saying what marriage is not. So don't say that Jesus never spoke to it or never addressed the issue. And so in the one flesh union that God designed marriage to be, God intends for a man to be united, notice, to his wife. Not a man united to another man, or a woman united to another woman. He said it is a man to be united to his wife. And this is the way God designed marriage to work. Physiologically, think about it. Emotionally and spiritually, God designed male and female uniquely for the marriage relationship as he designed it. Now listen carefully. Actively supporting or even passively condoning gay marriage, either personally or politically, reveals something about one's worldview. That either we live in a world and in a universe that was created and ordered and it is accountable to the truth of God, or we don't. And if we don't, then everyone is free to do what is right in their own eyes. I said that this issue of gay marriage must be the most vicious assault on the institution of marriage to ever come along. And the reason is that it puts our society on a dangerous, slippery slope in an unprecedented way. You see, if we are free to redefine marriage to not just be between a man and a woman, but could possibly also be available for a man and a man or a woman and a woman, then what's to say someone coming along and saying, you know what, they have their rights to marry, man, women, woman. I want several wives. You know, after you step onto that slippery slope, there's no stopping. I want several wives. They get their homosexual partners. I want multiple spouses, or I want a child, or an animal. Do you see the slippery slope we are on when we take that step? God designed marriage for procreation, and this isn't possible in a homosexual marriage. So gay couples who want to have children, well, they adopt, which is fine. Adoption is great. Or they will employ a surrogate. But you see, here once again, this is a poison and a toxic idea when it comes to children. Because what we know about children is that they are designed by God to be raised by a father and a mother. And in a homosexual relationship, a child is deprived of either a father or a mother, if children are included in the relationship. Now I want to just pause here, and another important point in all of this is that if this becomes the law of the land, then we could reach a time when my preaching a sermon like this would have legal ramifications. It becomes the law of the land, and we lose our right to speak out, our constitutional rights to speak, and also the separation of church and state. And for individuals working for companies like the one I mentioned earlier, there may be reprisals or even dismissal for not condoning homosexual marriage. But having said all of that, I need to just stop here and just remind us that homosexuality is not the super sin. And sometimes we treat it like that, and we treat people like that. The fact is that homosexual immorality is no worse than heterosexual immorality. It's all immorality in the eyes of God. And we should also remember the way Jesus treated people who were caught in sexual immorality. He treated them with love and respect, but he spoke the truth to them, and he didn't back down. So there is the truth of God's perfect, gracious, loving provision of marriage. Then there is the dangerous perversion of marriage, but there's one more thing you need to see here in Jesus' teaching, and that is the protection of marriage. The protection of marriage. And that's what Jesus was speaking about when he said in the last part of verse 6, "Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate." Now, obviously, Jesus is speaking about the protection of an individual marriage, and that is so important. And again, whenever I do weddings, I always remind a couple that the home that they are this day beginning is permanent, that nothing but the hand of death should ever separate them. Hebrews 13:4 says that marriage should be honored by all and the marriage bed kept pure, for God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral. The reason God did that, when God calls us to protect marriage, he's doing so. When he establishes boundaries for marriage, for the marriage bed, he's doing so because he understands and knows how marriage can be a blessing to a couple and to society, and how it can be catastrophic if it gets outside of those boundaries. He's given limits because he wants us to enjoy something powerfully beautiful within those limits. But there's a call also here, not just to protect individual marriage, but also to protect the institution of marriage. And I want to bring it down to this. In my mind, this is one of the most graphic reasons that I cannot support gay marriage. In Ephesians chapter 5, we have one of the lengthiest passages on the teachings of the way a Christian man and a Christian woman are to relate to one another in the institution of marriage. And after describing what the man is to do and the husband is to do in the relationship and what the woman is to do in the relationship, Paul comes down to the very end in verse 32 and he says, "This is a profound mystery, but I am talking about Christ and the church." What this telling us is that God has something greater in mind for marriage than just pleasure and procreation and prosperity. That God also has in mind through marriage a fourth purpose, and that is proclamation. That God wants through the relationship of a Christian man and a Christian woman as husband and wife to be a demonstration of the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ. That Christ loves us and gave himself up for us so that we could enjoy union with him and a relationship with him. And God designed marriage. The mystery is this, that marriage isn't just about us. It's about the glorious gospel. And friends, there is nothing, nothing that could degrade the gospel more than this hideous perversion of marriage. And so, friends, this is a hazardous idea, but it really all comes back to this. What is truth? Friends, if you hang your life on that, you'll never be led astray. You'll never go wrong.